This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. Afternoon, I'm John Williams. I'll be with you till noon. Anna DeVlantis is in the house, and she and Pete will guide you later this afternoon. Markets aren't doing as badly today as they did yesterday. Yesterday was a pounding. The Dow flirted with 1,000 down. It didn't close that badly, but it's not nearly so bad, that news on the market today. Orion, I guess you're watching that and the agribusiness scene today, right? Come on, O.
Indeed I am, because the markets do every day something different, and there are different reasons why, but I think we have to remember in stocks and in agriculture that the markets are called futures markets. That means they're looking at price activity in the future, not so much today. So that's what we have to put up with, because there have been some dramatic up and down moves recently in the stock market particularly, not so much in the agricultural markets, and I'll get into that a little bit later during the noon hour. But stock market today, a quiet day, I would say, compared to what it's been.
Yeah. Well, the NASDAQ's up 66 points, S&P's up 8, Dow has been off about 100.5, but compared to yesterday, we can do that. By the way, oh, you mentioned in your report a moment ago something about drones. I was talking to my friend George Butel, who is a farmer in Will and Grundy counties. He was telling me how they use drones. They send them up, and they look, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I guess see where the moisture is and how well the crops are doing, right?
Yeah, it's amazing what we can sense from the air, and that's why the drone has become a very important piece of equipment for agriculture, because you can go up above a cornfield, for example, and looking down from the drone, you can see where maybe there is a deficiency on fertilizer or there is a deficiency of moisture, and you'll have time to do something. You could turn the irrigator on, or it's a little late to get fertilizer on, but that's a great tool, and I know more and more farmers who have put that tool to work on their farm, or particularly the ranch, because ranches out west where cattle run over hundreds of acres, and it's tough to do a count that makes sense on them from the ground. You can do it from the air and get a pretty good sense of where cattle are on the rangeland.
I was telling George, I said, you know, the weather's been so nice, it'll be great to get out there and harvest that corn, and I bet you had a pretty good season. And he said, well, maybe not. We'll see, but it's been so dry. I think he would have preferred a little more rain this year.
Farmers always want more rain, and they always want more dry weather, because I know very few farmers who are satisfied on a month-by-month basis with moisture or with temperature or whatever. And now we're a little concerned about the frost potential, because we did have some frost in the northern part of the Midwest this week. I don't think a really killing frost, but certainly the pandemic taking its toll, because we have seen since the first of the year the disruption in our food supply chain, with packing plants and processing plants being shut down because of COVID-19, and that certainly cut into the supply of certain red meat cuts from pork and cattle, and even affected poultry output, because we couldn't get the product processed and couldn't get it moved to the supermarkets. I think we forget to realize how many different industries and people are involved in our food supply chain.
Yeah, although we do seem to have gotten over that production and distribution issue on meat and poultry. There was a period of time where some of the coolers at the grocery stores were empty or sparsely and, you know, populated, but now it seems to be pretty full. You go to the Jewel, and there's everything you need right there.
It is, and the challenge, of course, that producers had when a steer or a hog is due to be processed, you can't wait. But we've had to wait, and so we're still catching up. There are hogs and cattle that would have come to market earlier this year, but couldn't make it because the plants weren't able to take them. And so that is still affecting our food chain just a little bit, certainly not what it did earlier in the year.
Oh, I got to take a break for weather and all, and then we'll check with you later on. But just real quick, is it fair to ask how the crop is going to be in the Midwest for corn farmers this year?
Iowa really got hit about a month ago with the derecho that flattened the corn crop. It blew grain bins down. And so we're looking at crop conditions for corn in Iowa, which is our number one state for corn production. And I think this week it came in 42% good to excellent. And that was a drop of about 20% of what it was before the derecho. So always a concern about Mother Nature.
That's a Big O. We'll visit with him again in a little bit. Thank you, sir. John Williams here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Belinda O'Kelly is the co-founder and principal of O'Kelly Kasprick, a prominent architecture firm in Chicago. Kelly, thanks for joining us. I hope I got the, or Belinda, I hope I got the name of the business right, or the last name right. Did I do that correctly?
Yes, you did. Yep.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your business and how COVID-19 has changed a little bit because of it.
So, you know, we have an architecture and design studio here in Chicago. We primarily do hospitality design, and as you can imagine with COVID-19, you know, primarily focusing on restaurant bars and entertainment venues, you know, we've certainly seen the impact not only to our clients but even to ourselves in terms of having to, you know, pivot quickly and figure out how to handle a lot of these requirements and safety guidelines as they're literally coming off the presses. So, you know, a lot of our clients are struggling, and we're kind of struggling a little bit in terms of figuring out how to best serve them and help them through this time.
Give me an example.
So, like a lot of our, you know, we do restaurants, bars, and I think everyone sort of can understand easily what's happening in, across the restaurant service, but we also do a lot of business and institutional business and things like that. So, like a lot of our corporate clients have, you know, large cafeterias that they have going on, right? So, you know, and a lot of them are dealing with their populations maybe coming back on site, and they need help reorganizing and sort of helping how to handle the food service aspect of that business. So, you know, how do we keep people safe? How do we separate, you know, seating? How do we handle serving, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people on site from a food service perspective when we're just, you know, obviously not built to do that, right?
Is that going to happen? Do you see that happening, large groups coming back into buildings?
We have several corporate clients that are having that happen. You know, some as early as October 1st, and they're not necessarily all in Illinois, but they do have significant portions of their populations coming back on site. So obviously we want to make sure that we can help them handle the food service aspect of that as safely as possible. In most cases, it's helping them set up so they can do easy kind of order from your phone grab-and-go options through their cafes and then reorganizing the seating areas and providing barriers so that they can seat people safely.
That business of looking at a menu by taking a picture of it with your phone is the most amazing app. I mean, I guess that existed pre-COVID. You maybe know more about this than I do. I'm sure you do, but I didn't know that was possible, and what a clever idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So technology like that, you know, we're certainly across not only restaurants but hotels as well. We're leveraging those technology pieces to sort of, you know, obviously help everyone stay safe and limit the amount of person-to-person and also person-to-product contact that we have. You know, one of the concerns of all of this as we get into the digital age is we want to also make sure that we're not losing the hospitality aspect of hospitality, you know, through kind of only interfacing through text and app, you know, tech applications and things of that nature.
Should I judge my employer, my employee cafeteria, say, or any large food service area, should I judge its safety by how much contact other people have with the food? Like, are there sneeze trays in front of the salad, and there are no shared utensils? I mean, is that the driving factor here?
I, Honestly, I think it's, to me, it's making sure that any food service operation, whether it's a company or it's a restaurant, that they're taking COVID-19 regulations very seriously. So I think, you know, the most important thing by far is making sure they have a plan in place and that they are, you know, on top of kind of managing people's expectations. So, I look for a well-organized company or somebody that, you know, an entity that is, forward thinking in terms of organizing traffic flow so it's unidirectional, making sure that they have put safety protocol in place so that you are seeing things like barriers and certainly limiting the person-to-person contact, I think also is an indicator and is important. The other piece of this that's kind of behind the scenes is obviously there's a lot of visual things that we may be able to see, but one of the things that's maybe a little bit harder to understand is how operationally some of these businesses are handling the COVID-19 crisis. So I think there's a lot of, unfortunately with this, you know, it puts a lot of pressure on operators to sort of think through how they're running their businesses in ways that they've never really had to face before. And yeah, especially for small operators, this is extremely challenging.
Well, we think about the seating as customers, but you're talking also about the people preparing the food behind the scenes, huh?
Yep. Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, it's great to put up regulations and say things like, okay, you can only have 25% of your patrons here, but we also want you to make sure everyone's wearing a mask and we want to make sure that everyone's had their temperature taken or, you know, there's various guidelines across different states. But that's actually putting a lot of pressure on the owners of those businesses to have more staff. And so when you have a case where you're making less revenue, having more staff is obviously not as easy as things. So it's just putting a huge crunch on a lot of, especially the smaller businesses, certainly.
Are you recommending that the people that do eat in these public spaces sit catty corner, never directly facing anybody, or does that matter so much?
In terms of the science behind it, I think, you know, generally speaking, if you're coming in as a group, you know, I've certainly read that sitting kitty corner and not sitting directly across from people is beneficial. I mean, I think everyone has to take every precaution that they reasonably can. So I would say that that's certainly a good practice if you're meeting somebody that's not your immediate family or you know, close group. And especially in a restaurant situation where you're taking masks off, obviously, to eat your food, I don't think it's a bad precaution if you can manage it, certainly.
Is this a discipline you guys are just now mastering, or had you thought about these sorts of things all along?
Well, it's interesting because COVID does add a different lens to it, but we obviously, you know, in food service design, one of the things that we focus on quite a bit is food safety. So, you know, the transporting food, you know, off of a truck all the way to your plate, you know, we're constantly making sure that we're doing that in a safe way and that we can do things like control the temperature of food and that, you know, we are, you know, washing hands, obviously, and making sure that we're not, you know, transmitting any kind of bacteria or anything like that. The COVID piece is an extra layer, I think, because it's so transmittable by breathing and by, you know, face-to-face or personal contact, even within a certain distance. So that certainly added an additional layer. You know, the main things that I think a lot of businesses are doing are, you know, separating seating, trying to limit how many people are serving individual parties. You know, there's a lot of things that I think anyone who's kind of left their house has already seen in place. You know, as Chicago has actually come out just recently here with some more additional fall and winter dining guidances that they're putting out that allow us to take a little more advantage of open air and outdoor seating and things like that, because I think, you know, what we're going to see here is that, you know, the restaurants and bars took a big hit not getting the revenue from the NCAA tournament and St. Patrick's Day, and that kind of strung them out over the summer. But at least they had the patio dining piece. Now as we're going into fall and winter, we have an additional layer kind of pressure on these businesses that I think they're going to struggle with, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was interesting trying to buy a swimming pool, like, for your backyard over the summer. I think I think backyard heaters and area space heaters are going to be a premium this fall, going, you know, maybe even into December if they can stretch the season that long. Belinda O'Kelly is the co-founder and principal of O'Kelly Kasprick. It's an architecture firm in Chicago. You get the idea. This is what they do. OKellyKasprick.com. Belinda, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time and expertise today.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we do too. John Consulti's our next guest on the Wintrust Business Lunch. John, welcome to the show. We're glad you could join us.
Great. Great to be here, John.
Your latest venture is a company called Sped Exchange, SPEDXCHANG. And I understand that you are an expert not just in education but in special education issues. And as the virus has hit and changed education, it's probably made it even more complicated for that population, right?
Well, definitively. My specialization is bilingual speech-language pathology, and I've worked in special education for years. And I guess, special education has been challenging for all the teachers across the country because they've had to learn how to do service these children online. And a lot of the children that have issues, they have issues communicating, so you need to see facial expressions or you need to take turns, or socializing and being next to someone is part of the solution and part of the therapy in a lot of these kids' issues. So it's a struggle from the most basic element of what we do as clinicians or special educators.
What kind of students are we talking about here?
Children that are on the autism spectrum disorders, on the spectrum, or students that have communication disabilities, fluency problems, cognitive delays, anybody that's in that realm. There are children also that are behavior disordered or have a number of issues that are in need of a special educator.
Are the educators meeting the kids in classrooms? I thought that was a priority to get at least those kids back.
Well, it's really been kind of state by state, district by district. Most districts are developing policies to try to get students back, but a lot of times it's just not feasible to have the students back, and it's, to have them in a classroom, especially children that have special needs. It's particularly challenging for those teachers to be taking care of those kids, and the little ones too, pre-K, preschool. You can imagine, you're trying to tell students how to engage other people and play is part of education with younger children, but then you're trying to tell them to stay away from each other and not to be too close and maybe not to look directly at somebody or touch the things in a classroom that have been touched by other students. So it really is very difficult to service children on site in a school with special needs.
So if I'm doing it over a computer, and let's just talk about that for a second, what should the teachers be doing? What strategies do you have for them or maybe the parents that are helping the kids?
Well, parents are a big part of this. Parents are going to need to be there with the students, trying to be a facilitator of whatever the speech-language pathologist is doing, and also the classroom teacher. So being engaged and knowing the plan, getting familiar with the technology before the sessions. There's a lot of information online related to this, and that's a good start. The American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association has good information. There are some clinicians that are certified that have good recommendations, and the information's out there, but a big part of it is actually being involved.
Yeah, right.
And
your website is SPED Exchange, but Special Education Exchange, SPEDXCHANGE, is the website.
Yes.
And my understanding is that there's a shortage of teachers for a variety of reasons right now. Is that the case for special education teachers too then?
Yes, exactly. There are teacher shortages trends nationwide, and special education teachers really are even harder to find. They have special training, different types of credentials, some that require higher level degrees, master's degrees, school psychologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. All of these professions are, in high demand. There are not enough clinicians and special education experts or teachers with qualifications to do the work that we do. So, we try to attract more young people into these professions. High school students should start thinking about it. College students, if they're looking for a career.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. So, yeah, there is a shortage, and it's going to get worse. A lot of these, a lot of older teachers are, you know, they are at risk for getting COVID, and some of them are concerned about population and working, and there might be early retirements from some teachers. There might be changes in you know, how the pandemic affects staffing, and that's what we try to help school districts out with.
Yours is an online community of special education teachers, et cetera, and I guess the idea is to link those families, those school administrators, those schools, so that if there's a need in a certain area, people can go to your site and kind of find the match. Is that the idea?
Yes, we have a job board for special educators. It's very specific to special education, and we only help school districts, not private companies, to find these people. So we're trying to get school districts directly matched with people with highly specialized skills across a number of professions.
Yeah. Boy, right time, right place. I mean, if ever there was a need for something like this, John Consalvi looks like they're on it. CEO and founder of SPED Exchange, Special Education Exchange. .com. Good luck and nice to talk to you today, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Have a great week.
Yeah, you too. It's 1243. This is WGN. The business news continues on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. New data shows home sales in the Chicago area rose by the most in 7 years last month. The National Association of Realtors says sales and prices were both up. Experts say the numbers were driven by low interest rates and households looking for more space in the new stay-at-home era of COVID-19. The nine-county metropolitan area saw an increase of 19.6% over August of 2019. A New York-based home-finding business has launched in Chicago as it aims to help locals find homes to rent and buy. Chicago Inno says former tech developers at Waze, Via, and Taboola are behind Localize. The online platform allows users to find homes based on specific criteria like school proximity and nearby dog parks, among other things. The leaders of two big U.S. financial exchanges in Chicago have issued a warning to City Hall. The CEOs of CME Group and CBOE testified at a virtual Chicago City Council hearing, telling aldermen if the council pursues attacks on the exchange's financial transactions, both companies would leave the city. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth is on a phone line. We're talking a little bit about, I'm surprised to see this story, Amy. Let's start with the one that you were looking at about Facebook and this monstrous settlement that might include you and me, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It might include many of us right now. And that is a $650 million settlement that says Illinois users stand to get up to $400. This is a class action suit, and it's all around a violation of state privacy laws. So we've all been on Facebook, and a photo says, hey, would you like to tag so-and-so in this photo? That's all facial recognition. And so it's part of that, but it also other biometric data like fingerprints and things like that. If you're using that to get into the app to store, you know, rather than enter a password, if you have a fingerprint setting. So originally, the settlement was $550 million. A judge rejected that, and the company agreed to pay the $650 million. So people have up until November 23rd to file a claim. You will be notified if you are eligible to do so. You will get an email, or you might see it in your Facebook feed. So users are going to be notified according to court documents. They will probably get like a pop-up in their feed in between posts about your friend's cat and whatever your neighbor's doing for dinner. You'll see a little thing in there about, hey, you might be eligible for this. That is how Facebook is going to notify people. So if they stored a face template for you after June 7th, 2011, you are eligible to make a claim. So you can also, if you Google this, you can also find a website that will, you know, take you right to it. But Facebook's going to notify you. You're probably also going to get an email. The amount of money that each person gets is going to depend entirely on how many people apply for it. So if only three people apply, you know, they might stand to get quite a bit. But I imagine lots and lots of people are going to apply. And so we'll see. You know, we'll see what that number is. It could be up to $400 a person, but it could also be way lower if, you know, millions of people apply for it. So we shall see on that. I think a lot will be revealed after November 23rd when that deadline happens. Then we'll know how many people applied and have a better sense of how much each person will get. But I think that applies to most people. I mean, most people, unless you specifically opted out of it, probably have some degree of facial recognition profile stored in Facebook, or if you use your fingerprint, something like that. So I think it's worth it for everybody to just go check it out and see your privacy settings and see, you know, what data does Facebook know, but also to see if you're eligible for this.
It's a class action suit, and the deadline to make a claim is November 23rd. A big park is opening up downtown in a kind of unlikely place, huh?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a neat story. This kind of came out of nowhere. So the old post office, that ginormous building that you drive under when you're on Congress, there is a brand new giant park. It is three city blocks, but you would not know it if you're over there because it's on top of the building. There's some really beautiful photos that have been released. It's a 3.5-acre rooftop park. It has a bar. It's got tennis court. It's got all this green space. It's basketball court, not tennis. There's a running track there. I mean, it's really lovely. It was a $19 million park. It's being called the Meadows, right? After the one in New York, right? That's the Meadows. So it's kind of like modeled after that, right? And it's right on top of the old post office. I encourage everyone to kind of Google this and find the pictures because it's really beautiful. There's some aerial photos of what it looks like. I mean, obviously the bar part is not going to be a thing we're all doing right now. But to have this green space in that place of the city when for such a long time that old post office was kind of in question of what's going to happen there and what's going to happen with it. So 601W, who is the developer, they have attracted these huge, you know, huge tenants and Walgreens and Uber and Ferrara Candy and CBOE, like big, big, you know, groups in there. So this is kind of part of those amenities for tenants.
Wow. So it's the old post office. I guess it's open to the public. I know they're going to open up a sort of a food hall and plaza that will be open to the public next summer. But this isn't just for the tenants of that building, I guess is my point.
Yeah, that's right. I think from the beginning, when this company first started talking about redeveloping the old post office, there was really effort and a lot of language around make this area of the city a destination and really build it up and put a lot of retail and some walkways, right, and a lot of new things there, not just to attract tenants, but to make it a neighborhood, to make it a thing. Hmm. And I think this is part of that. And, you know, I think as more and more people are talking about the importance of green spaces, we'll probably see a lot more things like this. There are others throughout the city, but nothing quite this big, the size of three city blocks.
The Meadows. Google that. Nice to talk to you today, Amy. We'll look for that and we'll listen for you again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, John.